support a bill is to increase the deficit as much as possible. If you ever thought Republicans were fiscal conservatives, and not many in the horn do, well, this is the proof that no, Republicans spend, and cut taxes and make sure that we have debt. That is the main thing they're going to use to convince the Republicans to vote for the bill. It had some goodies in it. It had some things that a good Democrat like me can support, things like wind and solar tax cuts for those kinds of energy sources and mental health parity and a few other things. But at the end of the day, let's face it, this is a bill to give Republicans a lot of what they want. But I'm hopeful that this is the last Congress that ever meets under a Republican president for quite a long time. And assuming that Barack Obama does win, and I'll let you know why I think he will, and we have a Democratic Congress, we can reverse some of the worst parts of this and really move on. I mean, in many ways, I think this is the last clouds before the sunshine. Call me an eternal optimist, but I happen to believe not only that Obama will win the presidency, but that he's going to lead us out of this darkness. Not that it won't continue for a while, not that the pit that George Bush dug us in is not extremely deep, not that it won't take time to get us out of Iraq, to get our nation out of this economy, and even more time to get us back to fiscal sanity. I recognize all of that. And yet, that eternal optimist me thinks that actually we're on the cusp of a turnaround. And that doesn't mean to be complacent. It is still a month and 2 days before the election, a little less than 5 weeks now. And anything can happen in that time. But I do think that the race is Barack Obama's to lose. And I say that not just based on hopes, but on facts, on all of the many polls that I've been looking at. And I've been watching them every day. I don't know if you do what I do. I get up every day, and I watch all the latest polls. And then before I go to bed, I look at all the latest polls, and sometimes during the day. Okay, I'm a little bit obsessed. But I can tell you, if you haven't been quite as obsessed as I am, have been, that I've been saying for quite a long time that 260 electoral votes are in the bag. Signed, sealed, delivered. Yeah, we have to get Pennsylvania and Michigan, but I ain't worried. 260 electoral votes are signed, sealed, and delivered. They're the same votes, frankly, that Al Gore won, absent Florida, which technically they didn't give to Al Gore. They're the same votes Al Gore won, and in fact, back in 2000, with the addition of New Hampshire, would have given Gore the election. But Gore didn't win New Hampshire, and New Hampshire's not part of my 260. It is, if you like to look at the Kerry map, it's the Kerry states plus Iowa and New Mexico. And I've got a pretty good map of the United States in my head, so I'm going to rail them off. The 260, 100%, no question about it, these votes belong to Obama, even if McCain has another surge, are in the Northeast, where much of the Democratic base is located. We have in New England, Maine, skip New Hampshire, we have Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Then, of course, we have New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania. We have Delaware, Joe Biden's home state, and Maryland, and the District of Columbia. All of those votes are signed, sealed, and delivered. They're yours, Barack Obama. In the Midwest, we have Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa. Signed, sealed, and delivered. They're yours, Barack Obama. In the far west on the Pacific coast, there's no question Obama has Hawaii and the whole Pacific coast, Washington, Oregon, and California. And he certainly has New Mexico. Those are 260. Those are 260 he's always had. Now, I made the argument a couple weeks ago that Colorado made the difference. Colorado's 9 electoral votes gives him 269. That gives him a tie. And a tie goes to Barack Obama because the Democrats control the House of Representatives under the Constitution if there is a tie. And that's not inconceivable if McCain picks up some steam. It would be 269, 269. It's a weird part of the Constitution, the 12th Amendment. But it goes to the House of Representatives, which then votes in a weird way. Each state gets one vote. So California's 55 delegates get together, represent 30 million people, and deliver one vote for Barack Obama. And Wyoming's one congressman thinks about it and delivers his one vote representing 400-something thousand people, you know, about the size, smaller than a Los Angeles City Council's district, he gets a vote for John McCain. But notwithstanding that, we do control the state delegations, we Democrats. There are 27 state delegations today with a majority number of Democrats, 21 with a majority number of Republicans, and 2 that are split evenly down the middle. We'll assume they can't decide and don't cast a vote. In the worst of all worlds, if the Democrats lose some stuff in the House, which I strongly doubt, maybe we'll have 26 delegations. Not to worry, that's still a majority. Yes, a tie goes to Obama. It may be a little ugly, it may be a little messy. There are states like North Dakota and South Dakota with Democratic members of Congress from highly red states. Heck, Alaska's new representative is most, well, wait a minute, is it Alaska? Well, Alaska has the Senate race. Well, there are other states that are very red with the Democrats who are in the majority. But notwithstanding all that, I think a tie goes to Obama. Assuming that's true, and I think it is, then we know that Colorado would make the difference. 260 is in the bag, and 9, that's 269, that's a tie, Obama wins. And that's what I said all along. And then I've said that in order to avoid the tie, which after all doesn't look too pretty, right? You don't want to have a tie. To avoid the tie, then my home state, the state of Virginia, will make the difference. Barack Obama is now, by many polls, as ahead as 4 points in Virginia. In fact, some have put him as ahead as much as 8. I don't believe those. So Virginia, add that to the pile, along with Colorado, even without Colorado, the 260 that I promised you plus Virginia, that's 273. He's won the election. All I have to do is get out the vote in my home state, and bingo, Barack Obama is my next president. Pretty cool, huh? But it's not just Virginia and Colorado and even persnickety New Hampshire, which is likely to fall sway. No, today, the big swing states, the ones that we don't even need but would be very nice, Ohio, Florida. Ohio, the bane of Kerry election. Florida, the bane of the Gore election that was given to George Bush. Huge states, massive electoral votes. I mean, you know, California and New York have large numbers, but they're always Democratic. Texas is always Republican. Florida is the biggest swing state around, 27 electoral votes. He's ahead in Florida. Obama is ahead in Florida. By, well, you can mix them up, add them all up together, by probably a good 2 points. He's ahead in Ohio. He doesn't need Virginia or Colorado if he gets Ohio or Florida. He won't need particularly New Hampshire. He's also ahead in Nevada. A good swing state, a state that is red turning blue. But that's not the kicker. He's ahead in North Carolina. Okay, it's just by a point. It may go away. Some show him tied. Some show him slightly behind. But there are polls that show him ahead in North Carolina, a state that Bush won by 12 points in 2000 and 2004. He's nipping at the heels in Missouri and Indiana, Dan Quayle's home state, the most conservative state in the Midwest. Even Bob's home state of West Virginia, okay, will almost certainly go for McCain, but it's getting closer. It's getting closer there. So I don't want anyone to get complacent. I don't want anyone to think that we can stop working. These things change. 3 weeks ago, John McCain was ahead. 3 weeks ago, if this election had been held, John McCain would have won. So I don't want anyone to get complacent. But you can at least pick your spirits up. At this point, if the election were held today, our long national nightmare would be over. We would have not only a Democratic president, and someone, let's face it, who it's probably better for progressive causes than Bill Clinton, who I still have a lot of affection and respect for, but the biggest Democratic Senate in a generation. We're going to get at least 55, probably going to get 56 or 57. 58 is not out of the question, and even 60. Filibusterable proof 60. Now, I don't predict this. That would be too much to hope, but it's not impossible. We'll gain in the House as well. We will be able to finally put forward a progressive agenda. It's And so I refuse to be sad. I recognize there are problems ahead. It'll be interesting to watch the debate tonight. All of us hoping Sarah Palin does her typical flubs. And she's prepared. She's ready. She's gone to McCain summer camp, debate camp, right? They're training her. They're giving her all of the different things she needs to learn. I'm told that I do have a guest on the line, and I want to get right to him, though, because I want to talk specifically about the bailout bill, what it does and what it doesn't do. And I apologize for being a little slow to get to him. Robert Weiss, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Robert Weiss, are you there? We've had some phone problems with him in the past, and I'm not sure why that is. But, hello, Robert, are you there? Okay, we're going to get to him in a minute. Let me explain to him who he is. Robert Weiss is a lawyer who's been against the Wall Street fat cats, if you will. And, well, the reason I brought him on is because I am of two minds about this bailout bill. I, like Obama, very much want to protect, it's become a cliche, but protect Main Street, but at the same time as we punish Wall Street. I mean, Wall Street got us in this mess. I don't want them to succeed, but at the same time, I don't want our whole banking system to go down the hill. So, the question is, in this bailout bill, is how do we protect the credit markets? How do we make sure there is appropriate credit given for people who need it, for banks, for individuals, for people getting your car loans, people buying a loan at a furniture store, right? I mean, we need credit. But is this bill too costly? Robert Weiss, are you there?
How are you? Yes, I am.
Okay, hello? Terrific. Yes, yes. Welcome to the Inside Scoop, Robert, and I really appreciate your coming. As I understand it, you have a long history of fighting against some of the same Wall Street types and their practices that cause a lot of this mess.
Yeah, yes, I do. I've been fighting these guys for a long time, and I heard your introduction, and I think you did a very good job articulating the problem that many people have. That, you know, you don't want to help these guys out. The last thing you want to do is to bail them out for making bad mistakes and, you know, taking unreasonable risks and poor judgment. But you have a situation right here where the credit markets are freezing up, and if that happens, it's going to be an amazing amount of pain for, you know, just regular people. It's
well,
already happened.
Back. But before we get to the solution, and it's the good and the bad and the ugly of it, let me just go back to the problem, because we're hearing all kinds of different remarks about the problem. Republicans are blaming the fact that banks are loaning to poor people and African Americans. They say that's the problem. Democrats are saying it's a lack of regulation that caused the problem and allowed all these risky events. And in my view, part of it is simply that you're rewarded for bad judgment, that if you went and you took risky things, if they succeeded, you were rewarded, but because of golden parachutes and things like that, if you failed, you were rewarded, and you were paid every time you did a transaction. In your view, before we get to the solutions, Robert, what caused the problem?
Well, I mean, you know, there are multiple causes to it, but, you know, and the bottom line, I think, was just greed, and the government that, you know, was had no interest in regulating business, never had an interest in regulating anything. The FDA, if you've seen what's been going on there, you know, we have another case with the baby bottles, and the, you know, they're not regulating that area. They're not regulating pharmaceuticals. The SEC has basically been out to lunch during the entire time of the Bush administration. So you have just a lot of you have a unbridled greed on Wall Street, and you have no one watching, and this is what happens.
Well, let me ask you this: is the problem that there weren't the laws on the books to regulate, or is it that the administration simply didn't choose to use the laws that were on the books to regulate Wall Street?
No, the laws are on the books. I mean, I think that we need to, you know, tighten up the laws, you know, considerably. But if the laws that were on the books had been followed, this wouldn't have happened. And there was really no meaningful regulation of any of it. I mean, you know, if you ever got a situation where a certain percentage of this bailout bill were earmarked for a Justice Department investigation, and you had the ability to go and fight the lawyers that the CEOs are going to be able to hire to defend themselves as they argue transaction by transaction, you'll find that the, you know, the regulatory schemes that had been in place were just completely ignored.
Now, to what extent can either presidential candidate be blamed for this? John McCain says that 2 years ago he said something about Freddie and Fannie. Barack Obama says that McCain, while Obama talked about real need for regulation a year or two ago, McCain actually has been arguing for deregulation again and again and again. Who's right in this?
Well, in that particular instance, you know, McCain has been for deregulation and lack of regulation his entire career. You know, as he was sat as, you know, on the Commerce Committee of the Senate and was chairman of the Commerce Committee for a long time, and, you know, was very, very pro-business, very anti-regulation his entire career. Obama was not in that position, has not been, you know, against regulation, has been for regulation in general terms, but I don't think either one of them are really, you know, there's a whole culture, you know, they have to realize, in 2000, when George Bush ran against Al Gore for president, and you looked at the filings for who were the largest single contributors to Bush, the first 11 out of the top 12 were Wall Street firms and their accountants and their lawyers. You think about that. I think about there's no
11 out of 12. I knew Ken Lay, the head of Enron.
11 out of 12. And you got it, and the next one was WorldCom.
Interesting.
11 out of 12, and the one exception to that was Enron with Ken Lay, Enron.
Right. Now, you have made a practice of fighting companies, I guess, when they break the law, when they damage consumers. Is that what
you
do?
Well, I've been representing investors and consumers and individuals against big companies my entire career.
So what happens in your business, and I'll get to the bailout bill in a second, but what happens in your business, the difference between an Obama presidency and a McCain presidency?
Well, I mean, Obama would be much better for my business because I'm not telling you who I'm going to vote for, but I can tell you that for my business, Obama would be much better because we represent, you know, individuals, and the you know, the corporations have made during Bush's time with both tort reform in Congress when the Republicans controlled it, as well as a lot of really tough appointments to the federal court. It's very, very hard for Americans to stand up for their rights nowadays in court. And that it's much, much harder than it was, you know, 8 years ago before George Bush became president.
So largely through appointments, he would appoint more pro-consumer members of the court?
No, he anti-consumer, pro-business.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, Obama, if he became president, would have
more. Oh, yeah. Well, exactly. And, you know, if he had a Democratic Congress, then you'd have, you know, you'd have, if Obama became president, there would be an FDA that would have some teeth. There would be an SEC that would have some teeth. You know, there wouldn't be basically a revolving door of people who work as regulators and then go work in the industry, and then they can lobby and influence their friends who are still in government. So it would probably be much better for my business.
Let me move on now then to the bailout bill, and I'm going to play Lou Dobbs for a second. I am not my listeners know that these are not my politics, but give me a chance to play devil's advocate here. Because some of the things he says I agree with. And Lou Dobbs would say, now wait a minute. The government got us in this mess, you know, the lack of regulation of the Bush administration. Wall Street got us in this mess. They were taking risks. They were having the golden parachutes. They were messing up everything. And now the taxpayers have to bail everybody out.
And there's a lot of truth to that.
Well, I think there's truth to all of that.
Yeah, there is. There is. I mean, you do a very good Lou Dobbs impersonation.
Well, I can't make that. I can't make my face explode the way he does. But I gotta tell you, I mean, that kind of populist argument rings very true with me. I have reluctantly, you know, truth be on the table, I've reluctantly accepted that we probably need this, even though, you know, if I were in the Senate, I would grit my teeth, complain a lot, and probably vote for it. But my question for you is, let's just take the Lou Dobbs argument on its face. Why can't we just let these companies fail? Isn't that what capitalism
does? Well, the reason is because right now you're in a situation where you have a credit crunch, and there's a lot of businesses that depend on short-term commercial paper that just can't get it. In other words, like, you go down to the grocery store, the company or the person, well, let's say it's an individual owns the grocery store, mom and pop grocery store, all right? That those people don't wait to sell their groceries to buy new groceries. They do it on credit. That's why there's always bread on the shelves. And all these sales are on credit, short-term credit. Every retailer, everyone who works in retail, in a mall, they buy the clothes now for the Christmas holidays. They buy it on credit. They're not going to make their money until December. All retail makes 70% of its income in 3 weeks right around Christmas.
So okay, but Rob, explain this.
I'm sorry. Let me just finish. Now, these people cannot get credit, so they're literally going to go out of business very, very quickly if something isn't done to open up the credit markets.
But Robert, here's my question. Okay, I'm the owner of Joe's Bank. I'm Joe's local bank, or you can call me Citibank or Washington Mutual. I don't care, but you can just call me Joe's Bank. I run Joe's Bank. I see that Ed's Grocery Store has come to me for credit to put the bread on the shelves. Every year for the last 15 years, every year Ed has come and paid me with the money he makes from grocery. Why wouldn't I lend to Ed? I mean, I've known him. I work with him. He's good credit. He's not a subprime mortgage owner.
Well, you have to realize the way Joe's Bank works. Joe's Bank takes in deposits, and the deposits are no bank in the world can survive if everyone called all the deposits. If everyone who has a deposit in his bank came in the same day and said, "Want my money back," Joe doesn't have it.
And
that's basically what's happening. Joe has to hold on to his money. He can't lend it out to mom and pop grocery store because he doesn't have it then. He has to hold on to his money because he doesn't know whether or not he's going to be able to. There's no liquidity. He can't borrow money from any other banks. He can't get any more deposits. There's no flowing through his bank. So he's kind of frozen. He's kind of stuck. He's afraid to lend it out to the grocery store because he may need it if someone comes in and calls the loan, calls their passbook deposit. And that, is the situation people are in right now.
Joe's problem isn't Ed. Ed's a good customer, a good loan. Joe's problem is people are pulling money from Joe's bank, and Joe can't get loans from other banks.
From other banks, right, precisely.
Well, now, people pulling money from the bank, I hope we can calm that. Anyone who knows anything about FDIC insurance knows that if you've got 100 grand or less in an account, you're safe. They're actually raising that to 250,000. That is a panic that hopefully all of us can stop, because that's just ridiculous. Don't pull your money from a bank, folks, unless you have more than 100,000 in a single account. So that
But there's plenty of accounts with more than $100,000 in it. I mean, business accounts, for instance, have, I'm sure that whatever business that you work for has more than $100,000 at some point in a payroll account, So there's, anything over $100,000 isn't insured. So if you're talking about $100,000 is a lot of money for a regular person on the street just to have in an account, in a passbook account. But $100,000 really isn't that much money for a business to run. So,
fair enough. And they are increasing the limits to 250,000, and that makes sense. But let me go to your other point, because I think this is the larger point. You said Joe can't get loans from other banks. Well, now, I know a bank, a really good bank, that I assure you has the cash to give to Joe. It's called the Federal Reserve, and it can loan practically unlimited amounts of money to practically anybody. Instead of having a $700 billion plan to buy out all these, assets that are kind of shadowy and we're not quite sure what they are, and they all may be waste. Who knows what they are, these mortgages? Why can't the Fed simply issue easy credit to these banks? The problem is a credit crisis. Why do we taxpayers have to get involved at all?
Well, I mean, I can't answer the question, with the detail that it really needs, but I could tell you that a lot of these credit markets are based upon the Federal Reserve money is based upon, investors feeling comfortable with the Federal Reserve, and there has to be a certain comfort level in order for banks to do business with each other. There isn't that comfort level right now, so even though there are certain banks that can access the federal discount window and borrow from the bank, those banks right now that are able to do it are few, and they're not willing to lend the money out because they're not sure they're going to get the money back.
Is the Fed doesn't give money to every bank. It only gives money to certain select banks that are safe and profitable and that it feels it can trust, I guess.
Precisely. It doesn't give money to every bank, and it doesn't give money to a lot of financial institutions that act as banks need to act, for instance, insurance companies. When AIG failed, the Fed wasn't able to it didn't fail. They did a bailout of AIG.
Right.
But at one point, they were thinking about just, you know, allowing them to access the discount window, but they didn't do that because it would have opened up, you know, a Pandora's box of everything else. You're getting kind of far afield. You're getting into, you know, some economics and finance here, and I'm really a lawyer, but I can tell you that as a practical matter, right now, these credit markets are frozen. No one is lending anything. Car dealerships are going out of business. People are getting laid off. And if this thing does not pass, it's going to be worse. So, I mean, I'm in the same position that you're in, that you summed up so eloquently in the beginning of the, you know, of the program, as much, or the beginning of the segment. As much as you don't like it, I think they have to do it at this point.
Well, I agree with you. But the reason I'm playing devil's advocate a bit is important, because this thing is complex enough that, in my view, part of the reason for the failure of the vote on Monday in the House of Representatives, in fact, I think a large part of the reason, let's put aside politics and all of this, has to do with Americans not understanding why we need it. And so there's, listen, I used to work in a congressional office as an attorney in the House of Representatives, and I know what it's like when constituents start calling in. And folks, if you think your call to your congressman doesn't matter, you're wrong. It does matter. And I know that at one point the calls were 40 or 50 to 1 against the bill. Now, I also know that since Monday they've changed, and now the calls are about equal on both sides. But what I think hasn't been done, Robert, even though you and I have the same position on this bill, but I don't think it's been explained to the American people, to my listeners, to me, why exactly this particular method of solving the credit crunch is the right one, rather than, as I said, the Federal Reserve lending money, or even the federal government lending money. We did a Chrysler bailout, right? We lent money to the company. They paid it back. We lent money to Mexico. They paid it back. Why does it have to be that we buy off these shadowy securities derivatives? Why can't we loan people the money, even from the federal government?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a good question. I don't have the answer to the question, you know, off the top of my head. I could tell you that this is the solution that the people who were responsible for putting the solution in place, you know, came up with.
No, that's true. And I even said to my listeners, I don't necessarily understand it, but I trust Barney Frank. And so partly I'm supporting it based on that trust, even though I wonder about these alternatives.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you know, you could, it's possible that, you know, in hindsight, in retrospect, we did too much or we didn't do enough. The problem that I see more likely, especially as this goes more, you know, goes longer, and you're starting to see more and more ripple effects through the economy almost on an hourly basis, it's very likely that this $700 billion just isn't enough to do anything. In other words,
wow.
we could do the $700 billion bailout, or we can do $700 billion the way you want to do it, and it still wouldn't work. They put $680 billion into the federal bank and the national banks of many countries act in coordinated fashion, put $680 billion into the market the day it fell 777,000, into the banking system, the day the market fell 777 points. That money did nothing. So,
you can go through a lot of money
real quickly in one of these meltdowns.
Right, and I understand that's even what happened in the Great Depression. I mean, everyone did a run on the banks. But I guess at the end of the day, and let me go back to...
My grandfather was in line. It was a family story. He got his money out, and the family was able to weather the Depression. The people in the back of the line didn't.
Wow. But here's the thing, Robert, and this goes back to your and my shared predilections about the Wall Street people. Okay, I understand Barack Obama said it. He said, look, you can complain about the guy who smokes in bed and left the stove on, but better to put out the fire first and then complain about him later. All right, fine. I'll grit my teeth and put out the fire. But I still want to punish the smoker. I want to punish these Wall Street firms. I want to make sure...
I'll tell you what I think we should do to punish
them. Not just that people don't get golden parachutes if they get money from the government. I don't think anyone should get a golden parachute. I believe in capitalism. If you succeed in your business, pay you. I'm fine with that. Make a lot of money. But if you fail in your business, you should never be paid.
I agree. I agree. I mean, I think that the thing that would work the best would be to have a certain percentage of this bill, this money earmarked basically for prosecuting these guys. I mean, because these cases are extremely complex. You can't, in other words, like when they went after Ken Lay and Bernie Ebers from WorldCom, it cost $20 million for those trials. I mean, it costs a lot of money to try these cases because they get the best lawyers that money can buy, and they argue every transaction. So you really spend a lot of money. It would cost.
But Robert, at the end of the day,
I'm sorry.
As you could say, at the end of the day, we put them in jail, and so what? I mean, Ken Lay.
Well, you also have forfeiture.
Stealing $40 billion or so. He didn't even go to jail because he got lucky enough to die first, and then his family got to keep his money. They got to keep the theft. How do we get the money back?
Well, you know, when there's a conviction, there's forfeiture provisions. Like, for instance, Bernie Evers from WorldCom lost millions of dollars. I mean, not all of it, but, you know, millions of dollars the government was able to recover under forfeiture provisions. So really what you need to do is, if the government is in this situation, because the government is really us in this instance, I mean, you know, even though, you know, sometimes you don't like the government is the people here, it's our money. You know, the government needs to be very aggressive in prosecuting these people. And they need to, and that's a function of money too. You know, you can get a bunch of, you know, idealistic lawyers out of law school who are great lawyers and willing to work all night and everything like that, but you still can't fight White and Case if they're spending $20 million in legal fees unless you're going to spend the equivalent amount on the other side. And that's what needs to be done.
Robert, I remember, because I worked in Congress in the early part of this decade, and one of the main things that Bush wanted was to pay SEC lawyers as little as possible. At the time, they were paying them about $80,000 a year when their counterparts were receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
It was less than what a lawyer gets out of a first-rate law school. And we said, pay the SEC lawyers more so they can go up against these criminals. And Bush was very much opposed to it, and we didn't succeed early on.
The reason he was opposed to it, because he didn't want a vibrant, you know, competitive SEC. He wanted the lawyers for the private companies to run circles around the SEC.
But at the end of the day, Robert, I mean, don't we only fight this after the horse is out of the barn? I mean, so what? So, you know, we prosecute Ken Lay. He got lucky enough to die, which actually really makes me mad. It seems to me that if you have a conviction, you're up on appeal, you should still get the forfeiture. But even with Bernie Evers. Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, first of all, there'd be a big deterrent effect, because the last thing these guys want to go, you know, these guys are masters of the universe, the last thing they want to do is to go to jail. So once you see, you know, I mean, if you put $7 billion, let's say you took 1% of this and put it into a special Justice Department, you know, provision, unit, and they were able to spend that much money over a period of 5 years, you get thousands of convictions.
And well, let me ask you,
that would have a deterrent effect. I mean, the horse is out of the barn is a function of time. So you can't turn back time. You can't go back to 2003 when these loans were being made to the, you know, the bad subprime loans were being made. You can't go back to the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and unrepeal it. So all you can do is go prospectively forward, and I think that's the way to go.
Well, in terms of prospectively forward, I want to talk about a legal possibility. I'm going to throw out a little bit of Latin here that lawyers understand, that some of my listeners are pretty sophisticated. But there's something called a qui tam action, which is sounds obscure, but what it basically means is, if you discover that there's fraud going on in the government and the government won't prosecute its own fraud, you, citizen, legislature, you know, Don Quixote can get on your horse, fight the fraud on behalf of the government, and if you win, you get a piece of it for yourself. It's a great way to have citizens' watchdogs watch the government. Two questions. One, why hasn't this been done more in the past, and is it just the qui tam actions aren't structured enough to allow it to do it? And two, do you support more of those in the future to allow citizens to watch the government?
I absolutely support an expansion of private rights of action. I think the closest thing we have to a democracy, even though it's been eviscerated, is the court system. It's particularly, true in the baby bottle cases I'm working on. I mean, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with those cases. There's a plastic in baby bottles that when you heat it, it's called bisphenol A. When you heat it, it leaks micrograms of estrogen into the baby's formula, and it's caused a tremendous amount of cancer, heart attacks, you know, genital deficiencies, all sorts of, sexual gender confusion, all kinds of problems. And the companies are fighting this. It's like, you know, you have these moms against these huge chemical companies, and based upon, you know, the way the internet is right now and the way class actions are right now, the moms actually have a chance. They were able to pull, we were successful in pulling 3 out of the 7 manufacturers off the market. And you know, a lot of justice has been done and a lot of justice continues to be done. So you do have the ability through the courts for individuals, and I definitely support it. Qui-tam is a little bit different than that. Qui-tam is usually when there's a specific transaction or there's a specific, it's not a regulatory function. It's when let's say a company violates OSHA or violates an accounting standard, violates a particular standard.
You have like Halliburton overcharging for...
Precisely. Those kind of overcharging cases are what Qui-tam is about. It's not really when the government... You really can't sue the government for negligent performance of a governmental function because that's a political function. In other words, George Bush was elected president of the United States, at least the second time he was elected. It was a fair election. He was president of the United States. So he's the one who makes a decision, a political decision, as to what type of regulation that the SEC and the FDA and all these companies do. So you can't go in afterwards and sue them and say, no, that's wrong. The right remedy for that is the political remedy.
Right, but if the SEC fails to regulate a company, the company is going around and violating the law, and the SEC doesn't do anything about it. The Justice Department does nothing about it. Is there anything that citizens can do other than, you know, throw out the bums and elect a new government?
No. You can't, like, for instance, let's say the district attorney in your town, doesn't prosecute somebody you think should be prosecuted. Some guy goes in, you know, beats up your friend in a bar or whatever it is, and they decline to prosecute. They say it's self-defense. You can't sue that DA saying, wait a minute, you should have done your job better. You can run against the FDA, the DA, and win. You can support a candidate. You can contribute to a candidate, but you can't sue a governmental official for negligent performance of a governmental function, and that's basically what you're talking about here. So quit-tam wouldn't work in it, but there are a million ways that you can expand the private rights of action of citizenship, and that's exactly what the tort reformers don't want to do. That's what I do want to do, and what you're saying has a lot of validity.
Let me go back to the bailout bill, because at the end of the day, it seems that what you're saying, and I'm not even saying you're wrong, but it just kind of galls me that what you're saying, and it's kind of what I'm saying, is that the reason for this particular plan is kind of trust. And I do trust Chris Dodd. I do trust Barney Frank. These are people who've been around a very long time, are very sophisticated. They're very intelligent. So, again, it makes my stomach tie in knots. But at the end of the day, I think they're probably right. I don't trust Paulson, who, you know, is the Goldman Sachs guy who made $500 million himself. Seems to me like he's part of the problem. But if they all agree, you know, I guess I kind of have to accept it. But at the end of the day, after 8 years of George Bush, Americans are in a querulous mood. They don't want to accept from their government any of their government, Republicans or Democrats. I mean, I accept it because, heck, I'm a strong Democrat. But why should Americans trust that this solution is the right one?
Well, I mean, the problem is that you really don't have time to go through these complex plans and determine which would be the right thing to do. I mean, every single day that these credit markets freeze, people's jobs are going to be lost. People are, you know, businesses are going to, you know, go back, you know, years and years and years. Businesses that have been around for many years are folding. There's a series of car dealerships. I think Bill Hurd car dealership's been around for 70 years. He had 14 dealerships just went out of business. You're starting to see, in today's news, you're starting to see manufacturing jobs go. It's sort of spreading throughout the entire economy because the entire economy is based on credit. In my business, I mean, you know, I have a law firm. When somebody comes into my law firm and they want to sue the doctor who hurt them, you know, it could take 7 years for that. And I have to, I have to pay all the employees and all the lawyers who are working on the case until the case settles and hopefully make a profit at it. But it takes years, and I need financing. And, you know, most law firms that are in the business that I am are financed. Everybody's financed. It's just impossible to do business this way and have this type of goods and services, which are, you know, at your beck and call. If you ever read stories of the way people lived a couple of hundred years ago before any of this global economy, people lived much more simply. But, you know, it would be a dramatic downturn if for, you know, the lives of most people if this credit crunch continues. So you really don't have the opportunity to wait and look at these things as carefully as you'd want to. So you have to rely on Barney Frank and other people that you trust. You just have no choice in the matter.
But aren't we led to believe that this is sort of a magic pill? I mean, even if this is voted on tomorrow, and yes, folks, there is a vote in the House tomorrow, and I think at this point it's likely to pass, particularly with the $100 billion in extra goodies that they added, which will add to our deficit, and certainly the president will sign it. But, okay, so the bill becomes law tomorrow. The credit crunch doesn't automatically go away.
Well, that's the problem. The problem is that it may not work. It may not be that $700 billion may not be enough. It may be that we have to do what they're doing plus what you're saying. It may be that you have to do what they're suggesting plus what you're suggesting plus 20 other things. You don't know.
Yikes.
And that's exactly the problem. The fact is that what I think is going to happen is, I think this is going to pass, but I don't know if it's going to work.
So here we've thrown away $700 billion, perhaps, add another $100 billion. We already have the largest deficit in American history. We already have an economy teetering on a depression. It's already in a recession. This is not the time that you want to balance budgets. I mean, any good Keynesian will tell you that actually, while Bush wasted the money in the good times and in the bad times, you actually do want to go into debt. And this is a global crisis. It's not just the United States. We've got Europe.
This is serious stuff. This is real. Someone said that, I forget who it was, one of the big financiers, George Soros or somebody, said this is a crisis of a century. This is the equivalent. The last time we had anything close was the 1930s, and quite honestly, it's probably going to be worse, just because we were in
worse than the 1930s. No, come on, yeah. Rock. Not worse than 1930s. Not bread lines and people selling apples.
I wouldn't at all be surprised if you started to see lines forming at soup kitchens and people, you know, homeless and out of work. I mean, that's the effect of this. There's a lot of people, even as you realize, because I could sort of understand your politics a little bit from this conversation. You know, during the best of times, there were plenty of people who were struggling.
Yes, true.
That was during the best of times. Now, who do you think the first guy to get laid off is?
But Republicans will tell you, they'll tell you, Robert, that it is because of poor people wanting houses that we're in this mess. Right?
Wait,
I mean,
what? They have to say something, and that's what they're saying. And, you know, somewhere within there, there's a grain of truth, and it's twisted around a little bit. But it's really beside the point, because what's going to happen is you get a guy who's working for a grocery store that no longer could buy groceries. So that person, man or a woman, who's working in a low-end job, a checkout person, you know, is out of a job. And that's happening all over. We got the highest jobless claims in 7 years. Now, those people who are out of a job, they don't have much of a safety net, and there's not much going on. So you're going to – I'm telling you, if this continues, you're going to start to see bread lines similar to what happened in the 1930s. Now there's soup kitchens. You know, there's a little bit more – we're more sophisticated in a way. So, you know, it may not be quite as bad physically, where you may not see mass starvation like you did in the 30s. You saw a lot of starvation. You know, here you have situations where you probably be able to get emergency shipments of food, be able to get large homeless shelters. But there's a lot of people who are homeless now. All these people getting thrown out of their houses, where are they going?
Why can't we learn from history? 80 years ago, we had a stock market crash. We had a president that gave us a new deal that put a huge amount of government spending into things like the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation. They built bridges that today around Washington, D.C. still stand. They're very good, strong bridges. He put the people to work. He had massive deficit spending. The Republicans complained mightily at the time, but arguably it pulled us out. Some say it's World War II. But certainly the government spending helped pull us out of the Great Depression. Is that what we need? An Obama new?
That's a form of what we're doing. I mean, this is what we're doing. You got to realize this is the very opening round of this. I mean, you know, where they're basically trying to head it off. But assuming that they don't head it off, and we were, you know, you use the word depression, and that's, you know, pretty clearly to me where we're going. And if they don't head it off, then, you know, you're going to wind up years down the road when you have unemployment rates at 25, 30, 40% like it did in the Depression. Yeah, then you're going to need to put people to work and put them on national projects. It may not be building bridges. It may be, you know, something more high-tech, more involved with...
Build bridges. I mean, look at the one in Minneapolis. We need infrastructure in this country.
We do need infrastructure. You see what happened with the Olympics in China. They got infrastructure. We don't have infrastructure like that anymore.
You know, it's funny. When I go around today, still today, and I look at the best built buildings, almost in any city in America, you can go anywhere, and you see, oh, well, that was built in the 60s. That's a bunch of crap. That was built in the 30s. Yeah, that's a good, strong, solid building.
You're right. Built in the 30s. It's still around. It's a good building. That's a good point.
Well, because at that time they were trying to put people to work, and so they weren't worried about cutting costs every last penny. And lo and behold, when you spend a little more, you actually make a better quality product, and those buildings still stand today. Robert, I really appreciate you coming on the show and helping explain this to all of us. I mean, I'm worried because I was hoping you'd kind of answer some of my questions. Don't get me wrong. I don't have answers, so I don't know why I thought you would. But in terms of why this and not something else, but you scared me. I mean, I think the answer is that you're right. It may not work, but it's our only hope, and so we got to try it.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get a clear answer in a situation like this. It's like one of these things where, you know, it came up on everyone so fast. All of a sudden, you know, in a very, very short period of time, there's a $700 billion bailout package, and people who are opinion leaders like you, you know, are people are relying on you to make a decision on this, and, you know, what do you do? And you know, all the way up to Barney Frank and other people that you respect who you're relying on, they're in the same boat.
When Countrywide Bank failed, and this was already 6-9 months ago, based on the subprime stuff, and then nothing happened for a little while. It's like, okay, they were heavily involved, and then they messed up, they got punished, but what was the impact? I mean, the subprime problems have been around for, you know, several years now. What is it that caused this last huge group of dominoes to fall? Can you say?
Well, yeah, it was basically the failure of a major, major, institution.
Fannie and Freddie, AIG, what was it? Lehman?
Well, it was Fannie and Freddie the week before, which you know, increased the national debt. But when Lehman failed, and they realized, because Lehman had what they call counterparty risks, that there's a market, you probably read about it, called the credit default swap market.
Right. I have. I don't understand it, but I have read it.
It's very high. It's basically a derivative market on the kind of securities, the bonds, basically, that they group together on the mortgages. So they're basically making bets on the default rates of the mortgage. And this market was a huge unregulated market, trillions of dollars. And Lehman was a counterparty on a lot of these things. And then the institutions that were carrying these loans on their books or these transactions on their books all of a sudden had to write them down to nothing because Lehman collapsed.
I think I get it. So let me explain. So basically you have a bank and they've got these securities that they're not sure about. And in order to protect themselves against these securities being valueless, they put a bunch of money in Lehman, and Lehman promised them, don't worry if they go valueless, you know, we'll hedge your bets. And then Lehman went up.
It's not exactly that. What it is a transaction, and they're parties to the transaction. On the other side of the transaction is Lehman. And Lehman has to make good, you know, at some point the transaction clears, and you know, there's a winner and a loser, and Lehman has to either pay up or be paid. The problem is, when Lehman has to pay up, it's not there to pay up. So the people who are carrying these, they made a successful trade. They're carrying these on their books. This trade is worth $10 million to me, right? It's
right.
Not. It turns from a $10 million gain into a $20 million loss because they're unable to collect from Lehman. It's called counterparty risk. So what's happened is that's what, in my opinion, would really set the ball, you know, really rolling downhill fast.
Well, now, wait a minute. Are you saying that the government, having bailed out Bear Stearns, that if they'd bailed out Lehman, we maybe wouldn't have had the need for this $700 billion?
Well, they couldn't bail. They weren't able to bail out everyone because when they didn't bail out Lehman, the next week they had to bail out AIG, which even had more counterparty risk. The reason that they bailed out AIG was because they couldn't afford the AIG was a much larger company than Lehman. It had, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of employees and 70 different divisions, insurance companies, you know, throughout the entire world. Some of its businesses are very strong, but some of them, it had large exposure to this credit default swap market and had a lot of this counterparty risk. AIG was the counterparty on so many transactions that had that failed, then the entire system would have frozen, very much like it is now. So they bailed out AIG, and then they realized that they couldn't bail out every single thing. They had to basically take all these bad assets and try to put them into one place That was the plan. You know, this $700 billion fund is a fund to buy all these bad assets from all the banks. So that it was as a result of after not bailing out Lehman, seeing what happened, and then bailing out AIG and realizing that there were so many other companies to bail out, that was the reason for the $700 billion fund.
Okay, I'm starting to get it. But, Robert, how do we pay this off? No, I'm starting, but how do we pay this all back?
No, it's hard.
Before this happened, we had $400 billion deficits, lots of money being wasted. We had Bush insisting on the tax cuts. Obama, and I think he's doing this in order to win, so I can't really blame him. I mean, the last presidential candidate that admitted that he was going to raise taxes was Walter Mondale, and he lost 49 states in 1984. So everyone's saying they're going to have tax cuts. We already have $1 trillion added to the debt. The Iraq war is going on without end. All our money's going to oil. Is this just the decline of America? How the heck are we going to pay this all back?
Well, in many ways, it is the decline of America. You're right. I mean, and the problem is that, it's like, you could say whatever you want to say about George Bush, and you could, about Iraq and this and that. But, we're all in the same boat. I mean, it's very much the decline of America. And it's a question of how it's going to decline and whether or not it can come back up. So, the argument for the bailout package is that this will create at least a facility for a softer landing. Because, otherwise we're going to go down very hard.
But our national debt, $9 trillion, we just added another trillion just yesterday or tomorrow. That makes it $10 trillion, and then $11 trillion at the end of the day. And hopefully, in good times, not in bad times. But isn't some president going to have to raise taxes a whole bunch to pay for all this?
Or inflate the currency away? That's what they're doing.
Oh, great! Oh, that's the other option. Wonderful. There goes our nest egg. Well,
yeah.
Thank you for being such an optimistic.
I'm an optimistic person in my life, and I think that in general terms, things are going to be okay for most people. And I always try to comfort people, but you're asking questions that these are the answers.
Yeah, rather you tell us the truth than to sugarcoat it. I'll tell you this: my silver lining to this horrible black cloud is that. At least what it's done is it has taken a very close race and put Obama clearly on top. And my silver lining is thank God that this happened in September 08 rather than in mid-November of 08. Because if this had happened 2 months later with John McCain as president, heck, I might as well pack up my bags and leave the country now. So at least I think that this will give us a president who's more capable of handling this kind of crisis. That's my silver lining to the cloud. You don't have to comment since you didn't endorse anyone. But I really want to thank you for coming on the show, giving us
the
hard truth. I've asked you some tough questions, and frankly, you've probably given me the best answers that possibly could be given, even though there are no good answers in this circumstance. So I do want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was Robert Weiss. I hope he answered some of your questions. Like I said, he answered some of mine, and I asked him some tough ones. I had come to the conclusion, well, probably last week. You heard me. You heard it in my voice when I talked about the bailout last week. I didn't like it. I didn't like it. I don't want to bail out Wall Street. But I'm afraid they got us. They got us. They're holding our private parts and they're squeezing it. We can't do anything. They're pulling us down. The same people who got us in this mess, the ones that walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars playing risks, they risked us. They risked us. The people who claim to believe in free markets, claim to believe in deregulation, claim to believe that the best government is no government, were throwing all our money on the Vegas craps table, and when the dice rolled well, they won, and they got to keep every penny. Heck, they didn't even pay much taxes because the hedge funds would pay less as a percentage of taxes than their secretaries. The hedge fund managers made out like bandits. But when they rolled the dice and it came up snake eyes, they lost a little. We lost a lot. We didn't even know we were in the game. We taxpayers were being played for fools. Our money was on the line, and we didn't even know it. And all those Americans that said, government, stay out of my private life. Stay out of everybody's private life. I support that. But the people that said, government, stay out of our economic life. Don't regulate the big boys. If they make hundreds of millions of dollars, what's that in my business? It's no concern to me. Good for them. Good for them. I'm glad they're happy. Yes, it is your concern. Because those same people that made hundreds of millions of dollars, when they lost it, they took your nest egg. They took your bank account, they took your credit, and they threw it out the window. And all those people who believe in free markets, well, they're socialists now. Save me, Mr. Government, save me! And the worst part, the part that really hurts, the part that really makes me angry, is that we have to. That even I think we have to. They not only played us for fools, they won. They took our money, they threw it away, and they're making me pay for it. And you, and your children. Oh, God, your children, and certainly your grandchildren. To me, the only silver lining, apart from the fact that I'm looking forward to President Obama, is that we can never let this happen again. Never let this happen again. I remember people talking about the savings loans and loans crisis, which is far less than this, even though it costs hundreds of billions of dollars. Oh, that seems like a paltry small sum now. Probably, at the end of the day, it cost a mere $200 billion. All because of people like Ronald Reagan, who said the nine most terrifying words in the English language were, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Well, you know what? If the government had been there, they wouldn't need us to help. We have met the government, and it is us. Robert Weiss is absolutely right about that. They are us. And when we, the American people, say, just let the rich, leave them alone. Don't stop. Don't milk the rich. No more Robin Hood. Just let them make hundreds of millions of dollars. Don't worry about regulating them. So what? You're just jealous. Turns out, we did have reason to worry. Not only were they taking from our nest egg, but there is nothing we can do about it. So yes, I will grit my teeth and I will support the bailout. But don't let anyone say to you with a straight face ever again, oh, just leave the rich alone. They need to be watched. They need to be watched like hawks, and especially the big corporations. That's it for the Inside Scoop. Enjoy the Biden-Palin debate tonight. We'll be talking about that in detail next week. This is Mark Levine, on and off. We'll be right back.